We're back on the record then in the case of Dwyer versus Secretary HHS. Mr. Williams, you're going to close for us.
I'm going to do the closing on general causation, and Mr. Powers will address this case-specific issues here today. First, I want to thank you and Special Master Hastings, Special Master Smith Campbell for the attention you've given this case. I think this is the most important case any of us have ever worked on. If you think of the public health implications of your decision on general causation here, there are still millions of kids getting thimerosal in vaccines around the world. And what you decide is going to be very important in what happens in the future, not just in this country, but to those kids. I think that we have established that there is a biologically plausible mechanism of how thimerosal-containing vaccines can cause regressive autism in some children. First of all, neural inflammation can lead to regressive autism. I'm going to show you later diagrams from that show this is a generally accepted fact among the leading scientists doing research on the subject. We know from the adult monkey studies that inorganic mercury can cause neural inflammation. There's no question about that. Maybe a question about how much it takes. But there's no question that mercury, inorganic mercury in the brain can cause neural inflammation. That means there's no question that inorganic mercury can cause neural inflammation and autism. We know that thimerosal-containing vaccines deliver inorganic mercury to the brain. We know that from the Burbacher infant monkey model. We also know from all the studies on humans and primates that there's wide variability in the blood and brain levels of mercury after exposure, and therefore there must be some infants at the far end of what Dr. Brent admitted is a bell curve of susceptibility and the ability to handle autism, I mean ability to handle mercury, that some children are going to have very high exposures. Next slide, please. Now, the two world-leading experts on mercury toxicity were going to come and talk to us and give us their information on this important public health matter. For reasons we don't know, they're not here. But had they come, this we would have been able to use their own writings to show these facts.
Your Honor, I very rarely object during argument, but I do think that this is actually beyond what the scope of argument should be in a specific causation case. So I understand that we were going to hear some general causation, but a slide entitled What Magless and Clarkson Would Have Confirmed, if they want to put on evidence on that, the time to do that.
Well, I think we have some of those items in evidence.
All of these are in evidence, Your Honor.
We didn't list the the Burbacher infant monkey study is in evidence. You didn't list the exhibit number. I'm going to permit Mr. Williams to argue what he wants to argue. I would take exception that we don't know why they're not here. I think it's pretty clear from our status conferences that we understand why they are not here.
But
go ahead, Mr. Williams.
We did also, just to respond to the objection, we specifically reserved closing on general causation until today at the last hearing. Clarkson is a co-author of the Burbacher paper, and in that paper there is a statement that the microglial reaction to the inorganic mercury in the brains of those adult monkeys, we're talking about the adult monkey studies within the infant monkey paper, and they say it is not a protective mechanism, it is a toxic mechanism. That's Clarkson who says that. We also know, this is also out of the Burbacher paper, but it's one of Magus's own review papers in his CB, that the human brain-to-blood ratio is 6, whereas in the monkeys, in those infant monkeys, it's only 2.6, which means that in a human infant, 2.3 more times, 2.5 times more mercury will be deposited in the brain given the same dose into the arm. That's established in Magus's own writings, and it's established in the Burbacher paper. No evidence to the contrary. We also, it also says in the Burbacher paper that the infant macaques had blood levels that were comparable to the human infant levels in the three studies we have, two by Pinchicero and one by Stagets, of human infants who got thimerosal-containing vaccines and then had their blood levels measured. So it is reasonable to conclude that brain levels of inorganic mercury in some human infants are in the same range that ignited neural inflammation in those adult monkeys. I think we've established that thimerosal-containing vaccines belong on the list of potential environmental triggers of ASD, specifically regressive autism. We already know from the literature and from the testimony that there are several well-recognized environmental triggers: thalidomide, valproic acid, terbutaline, and although Dr. Leventhal didn't know it, terbutaline has actually been studied in a mechanistic way in that rat study that we gave you. Zerati is the first author, but again by the same group at Johns Hopkins, that established it is a neuroinflammatory mechanism that seems to be how terbutaline causes autism. We know that certain viruses can cause autism, again through neuroinflammation. And we know inorganic mercury belongs on the list because we know it causes neuroinflammation in monkeys. Now, epidemiology for a minute. The existing epidemiological studies are uninformative on the question of regressive autism. Everybody agreed with that. There is not one study that has actually tried to isolate regressive autism and compare it to kids that have taken thimerosal-containing vaccines. There's not one study on that subject. Not one study has ruled out an association between thimerosal-containing vaccines and regressive autism. And both Goodman agreed with Greenland on that. He said, well, he's technically correct that the numbers would allow regressive autism to be associated with thimerosal-containing vaccines even within the studies we have. So the existing epidemiology does not rule it out. Now, Fonbaum, he contradicts himself. And I think we showed that during the cross. First of all, he attacks all the studies that purport to show an increase in the rate of autism over time on the grounds that they inadequately detected it and that the real rate, we don't know what it is, but we know it's always much higher than what the old studies detected. Then he turns around and cites studies that purport to show an increase after removal of the vaccines and says that's evidence that the vaccines didn't cause autism. So he can't have it both ways. He's saying any study that finds an increase is unreliable, and then he turns around and says these studies that show an increase after removal of vaccines are reliable. It just doesn't make sense. There is epidemiology in favor of causation. The respondent has not refuted the Young VSD study, and I know you, in particular, Special Master Val, distrust the Geyers. The Geyers only provided access to that data. It was Dr. Young who did the analysis. She's a full-fledged epidemiologist here at George Washington. She did the analysis. Her letter clearly states that it could be duplicated easily, just run the program again. The government has it. If her analysis was wrong, we would have heard about that by now. We haven't. Fonbaum tried to critique it, but he clearly didn't understand it. On the chart that he made and showed you, he confused the two lines. He confused the one that was charting mercury exposure with the line that was the increase or change in the rate of ASD diagnoses. And then he also claimed that the study looked at linear correlations when it actually used nonlinear rate ratios. That's all explained in Dr. Young's May 30th letter to the court, which has not been rebutted or refuted by HHS. And again, if her analysis was wrong, HHS could really easily rerun that program and prove it, and that didn't happen. So I think that the only epidemiology we've got that's is in our favor. Now, the standard of proof in the program, as I understand it, does not require petitioner to have epidemiology to support causation. But if you special masters decide that under the facts of this case, that's the one thing we're lacking, that we needed to have an epidemiological study that links thimerosal-containing vaccines to autism, I think you've got to presume that those two VSD studies would come out in our favor. These are the studies that we tried to get access to do and were denied. These are the studies that a special panel of experts convened by NIH said should be done. And these are studies that Dr. Goodman, not only the defense epidemiologist in the case, but the epidemiologist on the IOM safety committee, vaccine safety committee, he told us on the stand in this trial, he thought they should be done. This administration won't do them. This administration that currently running HHS seems to want to decide this case without that data. I think you've got to presume. We're going to file a formal motion on this later, but we think that we're entitled to a presumption, that these kids are entitled to presumption, that those studies would come out in support of causation. Or there's still time. We think you've got the authority to issue an order authorizing the vaccine trust fund money to be spent to do those studies. Now, if you find that we must have epidemiological evidence, then you also ought to wait for the results of respondents to autism thimerosal-containing vaccine studies that are underway right now. We're very suspicious that the government wants to rush this case to a causation decision when the two most expensive studies it's doing on the question are going to be published later this year, not in time for you to have them. Julie Geberding, who's the NIH director today, said in a report to Congress, it's one of our exhibits, that both of these studies are finished and will be out in September or so of this year. I think you've got to at least wait do we have those studies? Because they're specifically on autism and thimerosal-containing vaccines. One of them is a case control study within the VSD, and one of them is this fortunate Italian randomized trial where a bunch of kids got different doses of thimerosal, and then they've gone back and examined them to see if there's any differences. We don't know what the results are. I presume HHS does, because at least one of these manuscripts is done. But they haven't offered that evidence here. If you decide that we have to have a primate brain study that shows TCVs ignite neural inflammation in the infant monkeys, we've got uncontradicted evidence that inorganic mercury causes neural inflammation in adult monkeys. We have uncontroverted evidence that TCVs deliver inorganic mercury to the brain of infant monkeys, but we don't have the brain pathology work yet from that Burbacher study. That's still coming. They're working on it. And again, this is a study funded by respondent. And if you're, now you may agree with us that we've already put on enough evidence, you can decide in our favor on general causation, but if you think we need this evidence, you should wait for it. It's coming. And it's partially within the control of the respondent as to when it gets delivered to you. So let me summarize again our biological plausibility argument. We know that the vaccines deliver inorganic mercury to the brain. We know the wide individual variability. We know that inorganic mercury persists in the brain for years. Some human infants will have inorganic mercury levels comparable to those that ignited the neural inflammation in those adult monkeys. Neural inflammation has been found in almost all the brains of human autistics when it's looked for, and persistent neural inflammation can explain the symptoms. And the Pardo group has two diagrams, one of which we showed Dr. Leventhal. This is one we didn't show. This is from a second article by the Pardo group reviewing this, and I wanted to pull this one up because it specifically shows that both infections, such as measles virus, and toxins, such as inorganic mercury or terbutaline, can affect postnatal brain development and brain maturation. It can explain all these neurobiological trajectories here and eventually lead to the result of autism spectrum disorders. This is a generally accepted model of how autism can be caused by both viruses and by toxins such as inorganic mercury. And then finally, the last diagram, the one we showed Dr. Leventhal, this specifically talks about the neuroglial activation being at the center of all of this, leading eventually to the regressive phenotype of autism. And I think under the standards of the program, we've proven that these vaccines, by delivering that inorganic mercury to the brain, in some kids, can cause neuroinflammation that can cause autism.
Mr. Powers?
Thank you, Special Master, and thank you to the other Special Masters. I echo Mr. Williams' sentiments, understanding the time and the energy and the effort that's gone into preparing and presenting and listening to these cases, and also from respondents' side, the effort that it's taken to get these cases to hearing in the first place, to develop the evidence and present the hearings. I also do want to thank the families. You know, the people who have been here, not just the folks who volunteered to be the test cases, but those families in the program that really have given Mr. Williams and myself and other members of the PSC the honor and the privilege of representing them here, and the huge amount of trust that they've placed on us and they've placed on the experts that have been presenting evidence here. So I want to acknowledge them and thank them and let them know what a privilege it is to be here on their behalf. I am going to talk about, as Mr. Williams said, individual causation here, and I'll be brief. If this was a civil trial, Special Master, I believe that, and these were the plaintiffs rather than the petitioners, would be entitled to a directed verdict. What you heard from Dr. Leventhal was wild speculation about things that were not in Colin Dwyer's medical records and opinions about his view of causation that are completely unsupported by the record. Let's first talk about the issue in Colin's case. As Dr. Leventhal said in his report, that he believes Colin Dwyer's autism is likely caused by a mix of genetic abnormalities. Now, he says that there's no genetic testing that's available in the record to confirm that or refute it, but I would explain to you, Special Master, that even if the genetic testing had been done, his own testimony was just a tiny minority of cases of autism have any sort of genetic identifiable abnormality associated with them. And so in the absence of any genetic testing, and you've heard the testimony from experts in the other test cases, that only about 10, perhaps 12% of cases of autism have known genetic causes. So all we can assume at most, even if he is right, that if that genetic testing had been done, there's only about a 10 to 12% chance that Colin would have been seen to have an identifiable genetic cause. So it's wild speculation at two levels. First, assuming, as he seems to do, that if the testing had been done, it might have showed something, but also assuming that in the absence of that testing, which is what we have here, that it's more likely than not that it was genetics. No, not a scintilla of evidence in support of that notion that he expressed in his report that this condition is caused by a genetic abnormality. Secondly, there is no evidence in the record that he was able to point to that showed evidence of early problems. And he went on at length about it's so subtle it might be missed. Well, sometimes it's so subtle that it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. And to, again, wild speculation, unsupported by the record, explicitly contradicted by the parents' testimony. This was a normally developing boy, a completely normal progress of development, with nothing in the record indicating anything related to autism had gone wrong before that first note in the chart at about 20 months of age when he had a language delay that was identified. And there was some debate about that 15-month chart note. You can debate that back and forth, but before 20 months, that literally is the only shred of evidence. And that tiny shred of evidence would not support a verdict, again, if this was a civil case. Everything else that he said on the issue was complete speculation and explicitly contradicted by the record and by the parents' testimony. Dr. Leventhal also talked about his understanding or belief. He would not want to use the word belief, but his understanding that there is no such thing as a regressive phenotype. Well, Special Master Vowell, you have heard in other of these cases and in the general causation testimony that peer-reviewed, published medical journals recognize, if not a diagnostic phenotype, a symptomatic phenotype of regression. You recall that Dr. Rust, when he testified in the King and Me cases, said that even aggressively, retrospectively analyzing medical records, interviewing parents, looking at videos, he sort of ran up against the wall. There are always about 20% of children with autism that, as hard as he looked retrospectively, appeared to have perfectly normal progress. And we offer, and the evidence supports, particularly the Dwyer's testimony, that Colin fits squarely in that 20%. And Dr. Leventhal's testimony to the contrary, again, completely speculative and without a basis in the evidence or the record, and is based on assumptions about a percentage in his patient population that clearly doesn't include Colin in this instance. Dr. Leventhal's testimony is a classic example of what I think it was Dr. Rust described with Tycho Brahe, where you're so fixed on an idea that you interpret evidence with such a strong bias towards what you think the ultimate answer is, that all the evidence looks like it answers that question the way you want to answer it, sort of looking through the telescope and even through the wrong end of the telescope. And as I said in the closing in the Mead and King cases, Dr. Rust was so fixed on the idea that autism looks like Rett's, Rett's is genetic, that therefore all autisms must be genetic, that his fixation on that Rett syndrome idea blinded him to the possibilities in the peer-reviewed scientific literature that suggested that there are environmental factors that may play a role, environmental factors that have been identified as playing a role. And you see that same sort of approach here with Dr. Leventhal, where even with the widely recognized, as Mr. Williams described, prenatal and some postnatal exposures that contribute to the appearance of autistic symptoms, Dr. Leventhal stubbornly refused to entertain the notion, except in the most narrow hypothetical manner, that environmental exposures interacting with genetic predispositions could result in the appearance of autism, particularly of regressive autism. And so you have yet another expert from the respondent side so fixed on a rigid idea that it's all genetic that they miss evidence that would support an alternative theory of causation. It's also important to mention, if you're looking at this genetics issue, really, for 10 years now, if you go back through the literature, there are indications that we're discovering new genetic abnormalities. And as we get more sophisticated and do better scans, we're going to find more and more. And Dr. Leventhal testified about that today. We're finding new anomalies all the time. Well, these folks who are looking for those anomalies have been doing it for at least a decade. Studies all over the country, and as you heard, it's still just a tiny, tiny percentage of autistic disorders are associated with an identifiable genetic contributing cause. There's something else out there, and these doctors, particularly Dr. Leventhal in this case, ought to be open to the idea that there is something else out there, and they should be open to that idea because it's supported by the literature. So because Dr. Leventhal's testimony consisted almost entirely of assumptions, a priori conclusions, speculation, contradicted by the record, contradicted by the parents' testimony, his testimony on causation in this specific case ought to be given very, very little weight. And you ought to decide, Special Master Vowell, that Colin Dwyer is entitled to compensation. And finally, in integrating the theory of general causation that Mr. Williams described and how you might approach applying that general theory to this case, one way to approach it, I suggest, is that you could look at the evidence right now points to, and the testimony and everything that's come in these hearings points to sort of three possible models. in explaining the etiology of autism, and particularly the etiology of Colin Dwyer's autism. The first is that nothing caused it. Well, scientifically, it's hard to accept and probably impossible to accept the idea that autism or any other medical condition is literally caused by nothing. But that is intellectually at least, or logically at least, a possibility that his autism and the autism of these other children has no cause. But we can rule that out because science won't accept that as a plausible conclusion. You're then left with two other possibilities. One is the general causation possibility that Mr. Williams described and is supported by the evidence in these cases, that thimerosal-containing vaccines in a child such as Colin Dwyer can contribute, and they're on the list in the differential diagnosis, and can be a substantial contributing cause of the autistic symptoms, particularly the regressive autism presentation that we see in Colin's case. That's a conclusion that's supported by both general causation evidence and case-specific evidence. There's the alternative theory, if you will, that seems to be suggested by Dr. Leventhal, which is that it was caused by something, but we don't know what that something is. And as you heard him testify in this case, the only thing that he could describe that would have contributed to Colin Dwyer's autistic regression was some genetic component. But you also heard him testify that that identifiable genetic component is only present in 10 to 12% of cases of autism. So his theory of causation in Colin's case is 10 to 12% likely to be true, but 88 to 90% likely to be untrue. And so under the standards of the program, there's no alternative theory that's viable supported by the evidence presented here by the respondent. So on the one hand, you have one of the competing theories ruled out legally by the standard in the vaccine program. Another theory, which is that nothing caused it, ruled out as a matter of scientific principle, and that leaves you with an evidence-based model and mechanism of causation in this case that associates thimerosal-containing vaccines with Colin Dwyer's symptoms and his autistic regression. It's supported by the general causation testimony and evidence, by the case-specific testimony and evidence, and it's that record that supports an award of compensation in this case for Colin Dwyer.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. Mr. Metnasker, you're closing for the respondent.
Yes, ma'am. First, I'd just like to thank the Dwyers. I see Mrs. Dwyer still in the courtroom. For allowing their case to go forward to help the court decide this important issue to be the third test case. I'm sure it wasn't an easy time, but probably the couple of days in courtroom don't compare with what dealing with children with autism is all about, and I'm sure that that's shared by families everywhere, those challenges, and in fact also no doubt some joys that are associated with that too. I am giving the closing. I drew the short straw. Although by the time we get up here, it must seem like we really enjoy ourselves doing this. We really don't. And I'm sure the court appreciates when we're brief. I'd hope to be a little briefer than I'll have to be, but I still hope to make it fairly short. First, I want to point out on the specific causation, lawyers are kind of slick. You move things around and kind of play a shell game. When I heard the comments about the specific causation case, it made it sound like respondent has a burden here to show what actually caused. Actually, the burden is on the petitioners to show the vaccine caused autism. And respondent doesn't have to show that it's genetic in origin. I think that the comments about Dr. Leventhal's testimony on that point are a little off the mark. What Dr. Leventhal was saying is essentially most folks who study autism as a profession believe that it's largely genetic in nature, and that's where the research has been directed, and in fact it's been fruitful in that regard. There's still much more to do, but everything that has come out has pointed to genetics as very strongly associated with autism. And most of the research that's been done has shown that autism would have a prenatal course, that it can essentially be seen, that the preconditions, if you will, for autism are in place beginning before birth in most instances. I think there also is a little bit of a misconception about what the force of Dr. Leventhal's testimony was. He basically was saying that Colin's case really is sadly no different than many of the cases that he sees, where there's a gradually emerging picture of difference, perhaps delays, but at least difference in the quality of behavior in a child as the child develops. It's not necessarily apparent right from the start. That's very rare. Most of the cases, it is apparent later, and it may seem that a child that has made reached certain milestones has subsequently had trouble keeping those milestones. As the condition progresses, there often is an improvement. That's the natural course of the condition. What Dr. Leventhal was saying is, as time has gone on, more and more of the researchers have realized that if you look back in the cases that apparently seem to have a normal trajectory and then there seemed to be a loss, that you see earlier signs and symptoms that all was not on a normal trajectory from the beginning. That was the force of his testimony, and that testimony was backed up by other testimony this court has heard before he took the stand. Dr. Lord, who specifically studied regressive autism, made that point quite clear, that as this has progressed, the concept of regressive autism has become more encompassing, that autism itself seems to have a progression where it appears that there's a loss, but when one goes back, one sees that there's unusual or differences in development earlier on in almost every case. And what Dr. Leventhal was saying is, as they've gotten better, the folks who do this for a living, the folks who make their lives about studying autism, they've realized that more and more of those cases, they can see the differences earlier on, and that in very few instances, when they've studied quite closely, do they see that there isn't some sign that the trajectory or the course is not the same as other children's. Dr. Mumper's testimony, which really wasn't much of a focus during the closing argument here, she seems to be relying on isolated lab results to come up to a conclusion that vaccines are the cause here. She's been asked in this case and in other cases, what would that pattern be? What do we need to look at? And in fact, there doesn't seem to be a particular pattern. In the King case, certain test results were relied upon to draw the conclusion that vaccines or thimerosal vaccines were associated with autism in that case or caused autism in that case. In the Mead case, other results were looked at and thought to be, by Dr. Mumper, indicative that vaccines were causing, or evidence that vaccines were causing autism. And now, in Collins' case, we see yet a different pattern of test results being relied upon to reach that conclusion. In fact, those test results, with really no pattern, how can one say that there is any kind of clinical evidence from these test results that one can rely on to make that kind, to draw those kind of conclusions that Dr. Mumper is relying on? And as you'll see when you go through the testimony, we believe that she largely moved away from relying on any specific test result, and when questioned about each specific one, she said that essentially that the mercury test result, the positive provocation, was really the only test that she had that showed that mercury was there and that she was relying on to implicate thimerosal as a cause in this case. But then she admitted that she really didn't know what the normal range would be for that test. How can one say that this is an abnormal result when one doesn't know what normal is. Her testimony seems to be formed largely by the Defeat Autism Now worldview, which is that toxins and heavy metals are implicated in autism. And to use the example that Mr. Powers used of Tycho Brahe, I think that comes to bear with her testimony as well. It doesn't matter which test result she's looking at. It always comes back to a heavy metal or a toxin, when it could be that the acidosis, that the lactic acid buildup, was because the child was crying, for example, when the test was taken. The scenario that we see played out with Colin, his course, is sadly played out too often amongst children with autism. It is played out not only in this country, but in other countries. It's played out across the globe, in fact. This gradually emerging picture of a child who seems to be slipping into autism, seems to have had some positive or normal development, but then gradually having more trouble speaking, gradually a gradual awareness, if you will, that the child is not developing in the same way as one would expect. This doesn't seem to be influenced by the presence of vaccination or not. It's, as I said, it's repeated around the globe, whether the children are vaccinated or not. It doesn't seem to be influenced by whether thimerosal is in those vaccines or not. As we've already seen in some of the studies that have come out, vaccines being in, or thimerosal being in the vaccines or not being in the vaccines, isn't changing the prevalence of autism. It continues to rise. It doesn't seem to have an impact on it. It doesn't change vaccination in the child who has autism. It doesn't change the clinical presentation of the case at all. It's the same clinical presentation, whether the child's vaccinated or not, and whether that vaccine that the child received had thimerosal or not. It simply is not having an impact at all. Again, there's just this is unfortunate. It's played out far too often, but it is not being influenced. The condition is not being influenced by vaccination. I want to touch now on the general causation, because that was the matter of some discussion by Mr. Williams. I see that the glutathione theory, which is where we started with this general causation case, seems to have dropped out. It wasn't in the opening statement. It wasn't in the closing statement. It seems that the theory of causation now is neuroinflammation, and largely seems to be neuroinflammation alone. That was a theory that Dr. Kinsborn recently advanced. In this case, it obviously wasn't present until just a couple of weeks before the trial in May. This is something that, after 6 years in the making, this seems to have come up kind of at the very end. Mr. Powers and Mr. Williams have focused on the causation burden and say that the information they've given on neuroinflammation meets that causation burden. That would be the causation. Their focus is on the causation burden under Alton and Grant, the specific criteria that they need to meet under that test that the court has articulated, the Federal Circuit's articulated. Respondent starts a little earlier than that, if you will, in the calculation, and that is about what evidence feeds into Olson and Grant. We start out with an analysis under Daubert about whether there's good scientific evidence to even meet that burden. So obviously, if the evidence that you have, or the evidence that's being offered, does not meet the criteria of good scientific or reliable evidence, then you have nothing at all to test about whether you've met your legal burden under Alton. Our position has been throughout this that the petitioner's evidence that they've offered, the testimony they've offered, fails to meet that standard of reliability that is set out under Daubert and that this court applies. Daubert stands for the proposition that there are not multiple kinds of scientific evidence, a kind for scientists to use and a kind for judges to use. There's only one kind of scientific evidence. It is the kind that scientists use. That's the kind the judges are supposed to be looking for as well. And when scientists or when witnesses come and present something that is not does not meet the standards that general scientists would use, then the court must reject that testimony, cannot use it. It cannot feed into a legal standard of causation. That's the problem the petitioners face right now. The testimony they've offered doesn't meet the Daubert standard. Now, the court's permitted the PSC 6 years to gather evidence and to find competent experts. They've permitted the formation of a large group of attorneys with essentially the resources of hundreds of other attorneys, at least theoretically, to help them advance their case. And they've permitted discovery. In short, they've permitted the court's given ample opportunity to develop a causation case here. What you ended up with, however, was speculation rather than good scientific evidence. And it was speculation that really came in, speculation that was kind of last minute, if you will, in the way it came up in terms of the neuroinflammation case. I'm going to just touch briefly on some of the things that Mr. Williams discussed, some of the specific pieces of evidence. He discussed the Burbacher study and then the adult monkey studies that were extensively discussed in the May trial. If you kind of distill that down to its kernel, what did the adult monkey studies tell us? That mercury given to these monkeys in amounts way exceeding those in childhood vaccines produced glial activation to some extent and no clinical symptoms. If you look at the Burbacher study essentially told us that that ethyl mercury leaves the body quickly, but some is converted to inorganic mercury. The amounts involved in that study were far below those in the adult monkey studies. But let's assume for a moment that after these autopsies are done, Dr. Burbacher, who, by the way, is not conducting studies at the United States government's behest. I'm not sure at whose behest he's conducting the studies that were mentioned by Mr. Williams, but it's not at the United States government's behest. Let's assume for a moment that he conducts his study and it comes back and it shows some sort of glial activation similar to what was seen in the earlier adult monkey studies. Well, we know in those studies at much higher levels of inorganic mercury and seeing glial activation, there was no clinical signs. What should we expect in terms of these studies then, if there are these autopsy results from the Burbacher study? There would be no clinical signs. Well, certainly autism has clinical signs because the families deal with that all the time. They also relied on the studies by Drs. Pardo, and we heard of the study, Lopez-Hurtado studies. The interesting thing about those is it wasn't a small group of patients of clearly regressive autistic children that we've heard premised as the phenotype for a vaccine-related autism. It was these findings of markers of neuroinflammation in these individuals was found across the board. It was not a specific phenotype. It was everyone. Now, certainly, the petitioners are not coming in here and saying that the 50-year-old people in Lopez-Hurtado, that every case of autism is caused by thimerosal and vaccines. This was a nonspecific finding that the Pardo group and Lopez Hurtado had seen in their in the autopsy studies. It was everyone. Dr. Pardo provided a letter trying to explain some of these results because of this sort of late development of the neuroinflammation theory. And as you know, he was ready to testify if the petitioners desired. Interestingly, although neuroinflammation is seeming to be the sole focus of their case now, they didn't want to hear from him, although they didn't want to cross-examine him, as it were, although they did, they are relying on his study, which he, of course, explained a bit in his letter that was provided to the court. There was also some discussion by Mr. Williams of epidemiology. Again, I think the notion of trying to say that the epidemiology that's come out since this allegation first came up can be dismissed because now we're now the petitioners are changing their focus to clearly regressive autism is certainly not borne out by the evidence. You can't dismiss this. The interesting thing about this their theory, and which was a little bit frustrating, I think, when we were going through the general causation, is as you asked each expert, is your theory, is your mechanism, whether it's glutathione or it's neuroinflammation, is that going to be limited to clearly regressive cases? And they said no. So why would the epidemiology then have to be limited to clearly regressive when the mechanism isn't? The mechanism that's being offered wouldn't just come up in a clearly regressive case. But apart from that, you've heard from respondents, experts who've studied autism, that there isn't this phenotype of clearly regressive autism. And that was the whole premise for throwing out, as it were, the epidemiological studies. There was some discussion about the petitioner's trial exhibit 17, a letter from Dr. Young. Also, the discussion of the epidemiological study that was introduced, I think it was the fifth day of trial, from with the authors of Young, Dyer, and Geyer. That epidemiological study was sponsored by the PSC, as I'm sure the court is aware from reading the acknowledgments. It was essentially done for litigation purposes. Dr. Young's letter, which is Petitioner's Trial Exhibit 17, I think there is a little housekeeping we have to do with respect to that. There was, when that was first introduced during the trial, I can explicitly remember saying that whether we would agree that it could be considered by the court was a matter that needed further discussion. But if it is considered by the court, I think it bears mentioned that there is actually some criticism of the study that's out there now. Mr. Williams said the government hasn't spoken, as if the government immediately turns around and can do an epidemiological study responding to what is a clearly flawed study in the course of a month. That's not how science has evolved. Good science actually takes a little while, and good epidemiological studies take a little while to do. I'm not suggesting that there would be any study done to reply to that. If one canvasses the comments that have come out since the PSC has released this study, they have uniformly criticized the methods used in that study, including criticisms by one of the petitioner's own experts, Dr. Greenland. To suggest that the silence of the government in the face of a litigation-generated, clearly flawed study means the government has no answer is simply not true. To hopefully wrap up here, again, the government's case is essentially saying that the petitioners have no good scientific evidence. Good scientific evidence isn't a hypothesis generated by a phone call from a petitioner's counsel to an expert who's appeared before the court in vaccine cases well over 100 times on myriad issues. That's not good science. an expert who or a witness who will come before you just a couple of weeks before trial, ginning up essentially a hypothesis strung together by little pieces of information, a study of adult monkeys many years ago, a study of infant monkeys more recently, a study of autistic patients a couple of years ago. That's not how good science is done. It's not courtroom-driven science. It's done by researchers. So the types of witnesses the government presented, the ones who are researching in the field of autism, that are making their profession, their lives, about researching autism. Daubert makes clear that the courtroom isn't the place for speculation and spurious reasoning, passed off as science simply because the witness who appears before you has a PhD or an MD after his or her name. It's about scientific method and scientific process. After 6 years and countless opportunities, the PSC has failed to offer any such evidence. Instead, it's offering essentially the same thing that you've seen in far too many vaccine cases, which is the same experts who seem to think that science in the courtroom is different than science that's practiced by the researchers outside it. And ironically, and I'm sure this was not lost on the court, the proponent of the hypothesis that's driving this litigation right now, the proponent of that hypothesis appeared before you, Special Master, only several months before he came up with that hypothesis, telling you that he could not conclude, based on the evidence, that thimerosal caused autism. And yet, after a phone call from the PSC, he did come up with that hypothesis just a couple of months later. And the irony, I'm sure, is not lost on the court either, that this witness who came up with this hypothesis of how vaccines are causing autism does not treat children with autism. In fact, does not even treat children for any neurologic conditions at this point. Petitioners have failed to meet their burden. They have no scientific evidence, period. Without scientific evidence, they cannot meet their burden under Grant and Olson. They can't prove general causation, and obviously if they can't prove general causation, they cannot prove specific causation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Brief rebuttal?
Very brief. First, on the allegation that this is a recent invention, if we'd been forced to try this case in 2004, two years after we started, we wouldn't have had the Burbacher infant monkey data. We wouldn't have had any of the neuroinflammation data at all. All of that was published in 2005 and later. Frankly, we have tried to resist the rush to decide this case because we know how many other important studies are going on that will inform the court on the very questions that where there may still be some doubt, like on the dose level of how much inorganic mercury it takes to set off neuroinflammation in infants. We don't think there's any need to decide the case in a hurry when we have so much important science still going on. But we are here, and I think we've proven our case. Now, as to whether there's a regressive phenotype or not, I think the best evidence you've seen, it's not created by our experts. It's from the medical literature, and it's the CHARGE study out of California where a group of independent epidemiologists, none of them connected to us, looked very hard at whether or not there was a true regression of both language and social interaction in some kids, and they found that, yes, in 15% of the autistic cases in California that they looked at, there was true regression of both those features. Now, it makes sense from a timing point of view. Neuroinflammation may well explain most autistic cases. It may well be that that's how thalidomide works. We have really good evidence that's how terbutaline works. And it's just a question of timing. It's when are you exposed to the agent that can trigger the neuroinflammation. In the case today, we heard that this child had early insults of mercury, earlier than most children got. But it could well be that the development of these regressive features happens as the neural inflammation gets going, and it can't start until they get enough mercury in their brain to trigger it. It makes sense that it would be regression, but that doesn't mean that neural inflammation doesn't explain other types of autism too, like the tributyline model. And Dr. it may well be that we didn't have Dr. Kinsborn available to give the opinion in this that we have to have ultimately from an MD that gives us causation. But Dr. Apogian, who is only a PhD, had cited all those neuroinflammation papers in his report way back in August of last year. So it wasn't that big a surprise that it was coming. And frankly, it's the one theory that makes the most sense when you look at all of the medical literature. I can't believe that they suggested that we were the ones that didn't want Pardo to come. We withdrew after we saw his letter and understood how it helped us. We withdrew our objection to his testimony and looked forward to it. And then the government realized that his letter didn't help them too much, and we didn't hear from Dr. Pardo. It's the accusation that we're the ones that tried to prevent his testimony. Frankly, if this court wanted to really get the facts, you've got the power to ask Dr. Pardo to come independent of us. You can call witnesses on your own. You don't have to wait for one of the parties here to call a witness. If you want to hear from Pardo, let's schedule a time and do it. That's all I've got.
Any sir rebuttal, Mr. Matnowski?
No, ma'am.
All right. Well, this then concludes the taking of evidence on the specific case of Colin Dwyer. What will happen now, for the benefit of those who are not familiar with this procedure, is that we'll generate transcripts of today's hearing. We'll probably have corrections to those transcripts along the model that we've been applying in the other cases. And at that point, we'll establish a briefing schedule that will allow the parties to submit post-hearing briefs. And we'll be scheduling that in one of our status conferences that we have routinely on the omnibus autism proceeding. Before we conclude today, however, I want to take this opportunity once again to thank the Dwyers for coming forward with their case. It is difficult to sit here and listen to experts analyze what happened and why it happened. And it takes extraordinary courage to not only live with an autistic child, but to allow the facts and circumstances of his birth and development to be publicly discussed. And we appreciate you and your husband's a willingness to do that. Mr. Farrell, we thank you and your law firm for advancing this case to give us that third test case when circumstances deprived us of the other third test case. So I thank you and the Dwyer family on behalf of my colleagues as well as myself. We'll endeavor to issue an opinion in this case when we conclude it's appropriate to do so. And that applies to, I'm sure, my colleagues in the other two cases on this theory. I would expect, however, that we'll be issuing the opinion on the first theory test cases first, and then to be followed by the opinion on the second theory that we've heard here. With that, this concludes. Mr. Powers, do you have anything? You look like you wanted to say something.
Yes, I did. I was not too subtle on that. I would stand up, but my foot has been cramping, so excuse me while I remain seated.
Texas rules.
I just wanted to just say something on the record in terms of a couple of things that the petitioners anticipate happening after this hearing concludes, but likely before, in fact, certainly before the briefing schedule kicks in. The first is that We do anticipate filing a couple of motions related to evidence. And Mr. Williams, for example, alluded, and we've talked about this in one of the status conference calls, about inferences that the petitioners are entitled to based on evidence that did not come in or that was unavailable. We anticipate getting motions like that filed pretty promptly here at the conclusion of this case. We also anticipate at least one motion relating to some additional evidence in this case. So it's another issue that we talked about in the status conferences, and this is about the toxicology evidence and the effect of Drs. Magos and Clarkson being withdrawn from the witness list and their reports being withdrawn. We believe that there should be an opportunity for the petitioners to submit some additional evidence, essentially in rebuttal, and it would be a motion that asking, understanding the orders of the court on June 17th and July 3rd, asking the court to reconsider those motions and potentially allow some very limited additional evidence. We anticipate that motion coming in. And then finally, Special Master, we mentioned it at the conclusion of the King and Me cases, but the petitioners want to make it clear on their record that as new, important, relevant evidence comes into the scientific literature, whether it's the HHS's population studies that Mr. Williams described, Dr. Burbacher's second phase of the monkey study, that as long up until a decision is reached in these cases, we would want leave to introduce that evidence into the record. And if leave is not given and agreed to, then again, we would have additional motions to file on those issues. So we have nothing filed right now, Special Master, but I didn't want to leave here today blindsiding anybody, but we do anticipate getting these teed up with you and serving them on respondent promptly.
Right. Anything further the respondent wishes to add?
Not to add, but not anything further, but to in response to Mr. Powers' suggestion that there's some motions coming. It was, I believe, either the second or third motion along that caught my attention, in particular, all of them did. Listening to all of them, but it was the suggestion that there's going to be essentially a motion to offer additional evidence on toxicology. The purpose of our status conference and when we talked about Dr. Clarkson and Magos not appearing, and then that was subject to some discussion, and then they said, okay, well then, if you still, you know, the court ruled in a certain way about allowing the record to remain open on general causation. So we said, all right, in light of that, then we'll just pull the expert reports of Dr. Clarkson and Magos. We didn't hear anything about a motion to continue the case at that point, to continue the record being open. And the court issued its ruling that came out in July 3rd, I believe, saying the record on general causation is closed. Now, if this is going to be revisited either through motions and perhaps the record ends up being reopened, respondent may then move to reintroduce Dr. Clarkson and Magnus's report. The idea was to be at an end. We're not in a rush to be, I mean, if you say we're in a rush, after 6 years, I hardly think that this trial...
We're rushing slowly.
Yeah, but there has to be an end at some point to allow you to make a decision. The inference that we're in a rush because we happen to know that there's information coming out that's harmful to us, there's obviously not. That inference should not be drawn. We just know that the trial was supposed to end in May. There were certain developments that came up because of the availability of doctors, Clarkson and Magos, that forced the record to remain open. We were addressing all these issues in May, trying to, okay, exactly what's going to happen in July? With respect to that, it was only going to be Dr. Clarkson and Magos coming back for testimony, but you know, we evaluated our case and decided we didn't actually need them to come back in July, and we thought the record would be closed at that point. We just want the record to be, well, we understood it to be closed on general causation. If it's going to remain open, then we may have to implore the court, move the court to allow us to go back or introduce other evidence in response to
to the new evidence that we've received from the petition?
Well, I'm sure that I'll speak for my colleagues and say we're always willing to reconsider a decision we've made, and that would apply with equal force to decisions in favor of petitioners and in favor of respondent. So if you give us good reason to reconsider, and we'll do it. If we don't think the reason's good, we won't.
That's what I would anticipate, Special Master.
All right. So we do anticipate some motions. Just as as a further housekeeping matter, I anticipate that the petitioner's master list will be filed into this case. The trial exhibits will be filed into this case, and the expert reports will be filed into this case. We're prior to this record itself being closed. At this point in this case, I've heard that testimony, but I haven't, and I've read those reports, but they're not filed into this case. So it's important that be done as soon as possible.
And we understand that we'll be working closely with Mr. Farrell and his law firm to make that happen in Collins' case.
All right, then the court is adjourned. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.